Welcome to Crosstalk. My name is Irene, and Crosstalk is one of the best podcasts in the universe of all time. Please like, subscribe, comment. We would love to hear what you guys have to say, good and bad. You know, we're open to criticism. And don't forget to, you know, follow or send us any questions. We are a not-for-profit. And so, you know, all of the proceeds go to creating more content, advocacy, and hopefully soon enough scholarships for people to get help. And today I have Tamara, who is an amazing friend of mine, and I'm so excited to hear her incredibly interesting story. So welcome.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
I'm so excited to have you.
Hey.
I remember when I first met you years ago. So I'm going to let you get started. You know, as you know a little bit about Crosstalk, we like to kind of get nitty gritty. So get as nitty gritty as you like.
Oh, dear.
And, you know, I'd love to hear just like, how did your life start? Where did you grow up? What did it look like? You know, any significant things that happened in your childhood that you think may have affected your using and abusing, and then what happens?
Yeah.
And what is it like today?
Yes. That's an important part always, right? To include and consider. So, especially for me, and it's something I've been giving thought to lately, just regarding like how different my life is now versus when I was in active addiction. And even like when I compare it with who I was before, not just through the self-knowledge I've gained through the 12 steps, but also like therapy and everything else, and how much better I handle things nowadays. But I did grow up in Florida. So I grew up in South Florida, specifically in Pompano. Shout out Pompano. you know, I was born into a family with sort of a legacy of addiction. There's a lot of addiction on both sides of my family. And so my mom and dad divorced when I was two. I never knew them to be married. And I look back on that and I'm like, wow, their divorce didn't really affect me. You know, I work with clients who they remember when their parents went through divorce, and the divorce itself did not affect me because I was two, you know, I was a baby. I don't remember anything from before. But I think that the legacy of divorce is different for different people, obviously. But for me, it was more like, you know, like, oh, I got to have two Christmases, or like, you know, mom, I spent most of my time with mom. Mom kind of raised me and my brother. And then dad was the one that like we went paintballing with and did fun stuff with. But, I do remember like from a young age, always seeking approval, like the approval of authority figures and anyone that was like up here in a power differential was really important to me. Starting with not just adults in my life, but especially like teachers, but also, you know, my dad. I always wanted to make my dad proud. And one thing that I can say, though, about the type of alcoholic that my dad was that he wasn't like an angry or violent alcoholic. Like there's no legacy of physical abuse or emotional abuse from my dad. It's kind of weird to say, but I almost consider myself fortunate in that respect because, you know, I do now being a mental health counselor, like I do work with a lot of people who the legacy of the way, I know I keep using that word, but like, you know, the after effect, the effect of the way that the non-present or the, I don't want to say harmful parent, but yeah, you know, of the alcoholic parent in their family or the addict parent in their family, I see how bad it can be. And I look at sort of the way my dad showed up, and he was able to show up for me at times. And when things were bad, the worst they were is just that he was sleepy or he wasn't, you know, like he wasn't fully engaged. And I never really felt like I could truly rely on him for anything. But he did give me like lots of words of affirmation, and I always knew he was proud of me and that he thought I was smart and, you know, that he loved me. I think my brother maybe had a different experience with my dad 'cause he lived with him for a while. But the reason my dad is such an integral part of my story is because, not only because of the, you know, the genetic component of alcoholism and addiction, but because his loss really affected me when he did end up passing away from the disease. And so my mom was very present. My mom was, a hairdresser and a single mom, essentially, for much of my life.
Did she ever talk about your dad's disease? Like, did you know when you were young, like, that's why he passed? Or did you know when you were young that that was his problem?
Wow, that's such a good question. One thing my mom was really excellent at was she didn't character assassinate my dad. She didn't triangulate, you know, and like say negative things about my dad. But it was not a secret that dad had a drinking problem. Mm. Like it was evident, you know. I'd go and spend time with dad. And I even remember as a young girl, like one time there was a cup. He liked to mix cheap vodka and orange soda. That was, yeah, like he was true blue. And, I remember one time picking up a cup, seeing orange soda and going, doop, doop. You know, I had a little sip and I put it down. I went, alcohol. And I was just like, ew, how gross, alcohol. Like I had no desire to engage with substances at that age or with alcohol or anything, but it was no mystery to me why dad was falling asleep on the couch or any of those things. But so she didn't discuss it explicitly, but it wasn't ever like an off limits topic or anything like that. That's a great question. Yeah. Because I think the way that our parents talk about what's going on in our family is important too.
Right.
Right. The way, like, what level of honesty or what level of transparency are we having with children when they're in families where these dynamics are present? And I think no topic was ever like off limits with my mom. And I even remember, so my dad did pass when I was 18, about to turn 19. And I remember about 2 years before he passed, he was an auto mechanic and he was very good auto mechanic. And we were on our backs under a truck and he was showing me something. That was one thing he was good at. Like I knew how to change a tire. I knew how to change oil, stuff like that. But, and we were sitting there together and the topic somehow came up that the doctor he had spoken to recently, because he was always in and out of the hospital with pancreatitis, that the doctor he had spoken to said, if you don't get sober or if you don't stop drinking the way that you are, you've got about 2 years. And 2 years later,
wow,
he was gone. So, you know, but I remember being with him once in the hospital because that was sort of that was a very present part of my middle school and high school experience was dad being in and out of the hospital. And just the callousness that the medical staff that he was assigned, the doctor specifically, the callousness they treated him with, like the way that they dismissed him and were like so exasperated and frustrated with him and how it came out in just not treating him like a person.
Wow. And you remember that?
I remember that. I do. I remember feeling so horrible for him because I was, you know, yeah, he's an alcoholic, but this is my dad. Like his daughter's sitting next to him. Like have a heart. And that's one thing it was at the time one of the reasons I wanted to become a doctor because, and we'll get there, but I did want to become a doctor when I was younger. I was like, I will never treat people that way. And now working in the mental health field and working with this disease constantly, I have an opportunity that I'm very grateful for where I get to follow through on that promise that I don't treat people that way. I'm not dismissive of them and I'm not callous to them and I'm not unkind to them just because this disease has them in its grips and won't let go. I think that there's a space for personal accountability. And I think that, you know, there is a space for asking people to own aspects of their actions, but I don't believe that we heal through shame. And I don't think I truly, through my own experience and my experience professionally, I don't think that shame is a significantly powerful enough driver of change.
Well, yeah. And it's not useful in any way. Like what use does shame have when we're recovering, you know, especially like staying in shame, is the worst place to stay.
Yeah. It keeps us locked in the cycle often. I know it kept me locked in the cycle. And so And that was also a sticky part of guiding people through their fourth step when I eventually was in a 12-step fellowship, was figuring out, how do we look at my part in things without making it about shame? How is it that I take accountability for the decisions I made without feeling like, okay, well, that's just more evidence that I'm a bad person and I don't deserve anything better. And I deserve what I get. And that's a reason to keep using. And so, like, that's something always to keep in your mind when you're, for me, when I'm doing work with people, whether it's therapeutic or it's 12-step work or whatever it is, that we're looking at accountability so we can find where our power is. We're not looking at it so we can feel ashamed and feel adequately, you know, bad about the things that we did.
Love that. That's so well said. That's beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think because once you figure out where you are in charge or were in charge or could be in charge, now you've got the key to what you can actually change. Yeah. Now you've found your power. And I love phrasing it that way.
I love that.
But getting back to, you know, the impact of everything when I was younger, I was like an overachiever. That was my jam.
Very aware, like, of this overachieving.
Yeah.
You're incredibly smart. And you said, you know, I'm not a doctor. I wanted to be a doctor, but quite frankly, you could be. And and you're one of the smartest. I mean, you are so well versed in so many things. Not to toot your horn or
Thank
anything.
You.
But it's true. And who knows, you already are halfway in that field. You may get your doctorate. That may happen.
You know, it's definitely one of the things I've continued to consider as my life proceeds. And it's funny because I look back and my motivation around it has changed. When I was younger, it was about getting the approval of other people. Like, it was about proving something to myself and other people. And I think it's also, like, there's a certain part of it where I try not to pathologize everything, because I also, now that I, you know, with the training and education I have now, I like, well, is that this? Is that this? Like, no, it's you're a human. Chill out. Some things are just like a normal part of development to want, and I very much wanted the approval and the, I wanted a reason to be able to not demand respect from people, but earn it. Like, I wanted proof that I was respect worthy, and the people that I looked up to, and, you know, even like the media figures that I looked up to, I wanted to be like them. Mm-hmm. So I was very academically oriented, and like in high school I played volleyball, and I was on JRTC and
what's JRTC?
Junior Reserve Officer Training Corps. So it's like the military, you know, when you see the high school kids in uniforms.
Yeah,
it's that.
Oh my gosh.
So you do, like, you know, you, it's like the little, like, pre-military-ish kind of thing. It's that extracurricular, and I loved it, and I was in leadership in that. And one thing that I always noticed I had a difficult time with, though, and I don't think I knew what this was until later, but I had a difficult time with follow through. I was a very good talker, but I had a hard time following through. I could, like, make commitments and stuff to people, but I wouldn't necessarily, like, follow up on it. And I think a lot of that, now that I know what I know,
yeah,
I struggled with ADHD. So I, oh my God, shock. Like, now I look back and I'm like, duh. But at the time I was just like, oh, I'm lazy. Like, I procrastinate. You know, I took it as like a moral failing rather than recognizing, like, oh, well, your brain works a certain way.
Right.
Yeah.
It's so funny because, you know, ADHD, people think that you're making excuses. And I'm like, no, when you really suffer from it, it's very real. It's very real. I recently saw actually a reel of Jay Shetty, and like someone's saying to him, like, oh, you know, he's telling him a story. And in his mind, he's like, wait a minute, is the metal iron? And then, but iron turns, like, literally. And I sent it to someone. I'm like, this is literally how my brain works. And so, I mean, I know what you mean, but there's those little things like the follow through, interrupt, like all those things.
Yeah.
So you didn't know when you were younger that that's what it was.
No, because I was because my masking skills were so good. You know what I mean? And at this point I had already experienced some trauma, but, I was able to get by enough that it wasn't like, oh, something's up with Tamara. We should take her to the doctor and get this checked out.
And any, do you want to talk about your trauma at all?
Yeah, I mean, some of it had to do with the addiction and alcoholism in my family. You know, I remember, so my mom did end up dating and then marrying a man that was my stepdad, and his name was Will. And he was great. He didn't try to replace dad or anything. But I do remember when his drinking got bad, because, you know, mom knows how to pick them. And I love mom to death. No offense, mom. I love you. Mwah. Shout out. But when her father was an alcoholic. So when there's this, when there's this pattern in the family, like, no wonder. But when she met Will, he wasn't drinking. And then his drinking got bad while they were together. And I remember... you know, it's funny. I said, I remember, but I don't remember this. This I heard from her.
Oh.
I came home from school one day and our shit was packed. She was like, guess what? New adventure. We're moving to Coral Springs. And I was like, cool, I guess.
Right.
I went to Pompano Beach.
Just how old?
I was in middle school.
That cannot be easy moving mid-school.
It was not. Specific.
And you can reinvent yourself. I mean, I guess it could go either way.
I tried to. And it's funny. I have this memory of, like, because I went to Tedder Elementary. So I guess this was right before middle school. But I was one of two white girls in my class, like in Pompano. You know what I mean? We lived in a very diverse area and most of the other kids were black and Hispanic, but I was at the age, like, I didn't really pay attention to that. I just knew how to get along and how to survive. And, like, yeah, I stood out and yeah, sometimes I got picked on, but that no more than I think like what normal, some within the range of normal, I'll say, school experiences would be. But then when we moved to Coral Springs, that for me was the culture shock. I went from a place where you got to have a little bit of an attitude to get by and, like, let people know what's up, to a place where social niceties and all these unwritten rules that I hadn't learned were, like, at play.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I show up thinking, like, I'm going to...
I'm a tough girl.
Yeah, I'm a tough girl. I remember
I'm
picking
a tough girl
out
who's crying on the inside.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Dying on the inside. Yeah, like, how dare you? What do you mean you don't like me? That's devastating. How could you? And I remember picking out my outfit for the first day of school, the brat shirt and the jean overalls. And I remember going in like with an attitude, like prepared to be defensive to people. And then I wondered why people didn't receive me well.
Mm.
Like,
but you don't know any better at that age,
right?
I mean, come on.
You're still figuring out the social rules, and all these other people had gone to school together for years. And I just remember I went from being the star pupil who was the overachiever and like the teacher's pet to having some adversarial relationships with adults in authority because of whatever the reason was, the way I was showing up and what I was going through. But I didn't really have the words or the wherewithal to like communicate this to anybody. And then, you know, I have an older brother. His name's Jeff, and I looked up to him my whole life, like, and just loved him so much. And we had our little tiffs and everything, like normal brother sister stuff, but I always wanted to be like him. I put on a pedestal, and I think this is also something probably other women can relate to. I idealized masculine traits, and I didn't realize this was the beginning of internalized misogyny, but I wanted to like, the legacy of that later on in life. But I wanted to be like him. And so, you know, when I did get into high school and I did do JROTC and Sea Cadets, which was another like military program, I just always wanted to be tough. Being tough was so important to me,
right?
Or seeming tough. And it had its own social consequences. But, and I remember one time in middle school too, and this experience stands out to me because I didn't realize really how different my family was until... relative to what was present, you know, in Coral Springs. I didn't realize that it was different until I had this experience. I was like popular crew adjacent enough that I got a birthday invitation to a girl's birthday party, one of the popular girls. And I showed up and it's like a two-story house with double doors and there's like stairs and in the kitchen there's an island. I'm like, why do you need another kitchen in your kitchen? Like, you know, and I lived in a one-bedroom apartment with my mom. So it was just like, I was like, what is going on here? Why are both parents here? That's overkill. Like, And my dad was in the hospital at the time. And I remember at some point during the night, I pulled a chair off to the side and I was like looking at the water out back of their porch. And the next day or the next time.
There's water out back.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Like, what is this doing here?
Yeah.
And when I got back to school, they had started a rumor that I was crazy and I was talking to the trees.
Oh.
And I was like,
they can start that rumor about me now.
Yeah.
I do that now.
Yeah. Yeah. Now people would be like, now they're probably the same people that are like, now, oh my God, I went to Peru and I like commune with nature. Like, well, I was doing that in middle school. So
yeah,
like,
exactly.
But it felt very like, okay, I'm different in a bad way was kind of what sunk in for me. Mm. And after that, I switched middle schools because we did end up moving again, still in the same city, but different school district. And at this new school, that was when I got to reinvent myself. And I went all the way. I wanted people to leave me alone. So I made sure like I was wearing Korn t-shirts, which Korn all the way, just went to their concert, 10 out of 10.
But you know, he's sober too.
Yeah. Head. Okay. Yeah. Brian Welch, one of the guitarists.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping to get him on the podcast.
Oh God, I hope so. Me too. If you do, you have to invite me because
just watch and Mike
I have
in the corner.
To meet him.
Okay,
because I have pictures of me with his hairstyle in middle school. I would make my mom do my hair. I was super into the music, but like it was the subculture of it that was inviting
right,
to me,
of course.
Like Korn and Slipknot and Limp Bizkit and Orgy and like that whole. I got to wear like eyeliner, and it was kind of like my way of rebelling. Of expressing some otherness that I had in me that I felt was, you know, so incredibly unique. And no one had ever felt the way that I felt. Which I say that dismissively now. But
at that time, that's how you felt.
Exactly.
Right.
But at the time,
was
it was so real.
Yeah.
It was so real.
I get that.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I get that.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, during that time, I think that was the first time I ever tried a substance. And the first substance I ever tried. I was ecstasy. I started hard.
You went,
went
all out.
I wasn't pulling any punches. Yeah, I went to raves and like, you know, rolled and alcohol was never really like a big part of my story until college. But yeah, I did ecstasy. And then, you know, one thing about the way that my house was, you know, my brother sometimes was living with us, sometimes was living with dad, but mom was kind of like one of the more stable family members. And so when people in our family needed help, like when my uncle needed somewhere to stay, he came and stayed with us. And mom didn't know this, but at the time the pill mills were going on, you know, the pain pills down here in South Florida. Mm. And he was doctor shopping and getting a bunch of pain pills.
Right.
And so the first time I ever tried one of those, it was courtesy of him. And I don't blame my uncle. He was active in his addiction. Obviously, he was the adult and he should have known better, yes. But I don't like harbor ill will towards him, you know. I've forgiven him for that because I did plenty of my own stuff after that.
I mean, and I think, do you ever think that like I probably would have gotten there anyway?
Yes.
Because I remember, you know, one of my family members was the one who put a whole bunch of, you know, weed on my table. And I was in already past college. And, you know, I don't blame that person.
Right.
Because, like, he didn't do this. He didn't roll the second joint for me and the third and the fourth and the fifth.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I did that. So yeah. I feel like a lot of people have asked me in the past, like, oh, do you blame them? And I said, no, you know, I don't. And so that I like that you said that you know he should have known better. Fine, but he didn't.
Yeah,
he was deep.
He's
in
not
it.
The reason I became an addict. Like I can honestly say that I would have found my way there one way or another.
Yeah,
because this, you know, as I'm talking about like the approval seeking and everything that I struggled with and some of the identity issues I struggled with, I do believe that I had that always looking for something part of the isms in me from a very young age. And substances became my answer to that emptiness after I lost my dad. Like I had dabbled here and there, but you know, my senior year in high school, I got an Air Force scholarship to go to Norwich University. Which was a military college in Vermont, a private military school. And that was what I wanted. Like I was so psyched. I was so excited. And, you know, at the very end of my senior year in high school, my stepfather passed away. he had gotten throat cancer.
Oh my God.
But
I'm
it wasn't
so sorry.
It was devastating because we did home hospice. It was really hard.
And you had just lost your dad.
No, that was a year later.
Okay.
It went stepdad, dad, uncle.
Oh God.
In that order. Yeah. So
I'm so sorry.
Thank you. When we lost Will, it was right before my high school graduation, and he had gotten throat cancer, and the radiation was successful. Like, he beat the cancer. He had been, I think, 5 years sober at this point, but his body sent the bill. Like, he didn't survive the radiation. So the radiation was what did him in and boxed his organs, and he couldn't recover from that. And so he ended up dying in our living room one weekday. I stayed home from school just because I didn't want to go. I was a senior. I was like, I'm skipping today. And it ended up being that Mom and I were next to his bed holding his hand when he passed, when he took his last breath.
Wow.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. Well, I haven't talked about that in a while. And during the rest of my I ended up doing a mural for him outside of the library in Coral Springs High School. So if that mural's still there, that's for my stepdad, Will. And then I went off to college, you know, and I had done things here and there. I had tried coke, or I'd done ecstasy, like I said, and I drank a little bit. But when I went to college, what I had in my mind was that, you know, this is going to be the beginning of my successful military career. And what happened instead was I came home for the summer in between my freshman and sophomore year, and Mom came home one day from work and said, you know, your dad's gone. And I just remember hitting the ground. It wasn't like we didn't know that it was coming, but that knowledge is not, you can't parse that with the moment you find out, you know? And then I look back and I'm grateful that he went when he did, because I was getting to the age where he wasn't going to keep the pedestal he was on for much longer. I was starting to get annoyed with certain things he did. And also, my dad wasn't there for the wreckage of my addiction. And so he didn't have to, number one, see that side of me. And number two, I can't imagine what would have happened to our relationship. I would have taken advantage of him. I would have, like, all the things, you know? Mm. And so not having to carry that, like, I'm able to see that blessing at the same time that I'm able to acknowledge, like, the life-altering pain of losing a dad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you lost your stepdad, who's, like, a figure for you, you know? That was in your direct household.
Yeah. Yeah. The father figure and male influence part of my life was something I struggled with for many years. And it's something I've worked on a lot in therapy, in, like, being able to come to terms with not having had, like, you know, that the most positive influence, and how that's affected me and how it's affected my relationships and the way I see myself and stuff like that. After Dad passed, that's when I can honestly say, like, things took a turn.
Yeah.
So I lost Dad, and we
went back to school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I was on scholarship, you know. It was important to me, and I was a member of the rugby team, and I was, you know, like, cadet leadership and all of these things that had always been, like, a really important part of my life. Mm-hmm. And still were an important part of my life. When it came to those feelings associated with grief or processing any of that, I just put it away.
Right.
Deep down. Yeah. And I think sometimes about, like, the things that we teach kids, what we do and don't teach them how to do. And two courses I would have absolutely benefited from in high school that were never given to me or anyone else were, like, financial management and how to deal with your feelings, like, how to process grief, how to talk to someone about what you're going through. Like,
I think that grief and the grief process is so personal to people. And, you know, it's funny because We have and are having a therapist on this podcast who is a grief counselor, and Eric Bricker. I don't know if you're familiar with mm-hmm. him, but he's excellent. And he talks about how you know, those stages of grief that they used to talk about in the past, those aren't real.
They're crap.
Yeah. That was like based on a woman who was in a hospice facility, right?
I'm so glad he's talking about that.
Yeah. And so actually, like, there is no right or wrong way, obviously. And there's no like method, like, oh, first you're going to feel this, that, the other. So,
right.
Yeah. I don't know how that class would work, but I do know that I was never taught about feelings.
Yeah.
Either. And I think treatment taught me that.
Yeah. Same here.
So maybe a group therapy class?
Yeah. Something. Yeah. Something about, or even like a communication class. And I don't mean like the type you get in college. I mean like how to talk to people. And, you know, when it comes to grief, I think one of the disservices that we've been done by our society, if you will, or by media portrayals of grief is thinking that it needs to look a certain way or thinking that it's supposed to follow a specific sequence.
Or you're going to go through the anger phase now.
Right. Yeah. Oh, that's just your anger phase.
Yeah.
Like,
No,
I'm angry and I'm sad and I'm guilty and I'm all these things at once. Cause the last conversation I ever had with my dad was an argument over what was on TV, you know, like, and I've been able to let that go, but it took some time of like that feeling of regret. My brother had it even worse with the loss of my dad because my brother was on his second deployment overseas.
Oh, so your brother's a military brat too.
Yeah. Well, we were both first generation military. I mean, our uncle had been in the service, but he and I both decided. Yeah, I kind of followed in his footsteps. He went to the Marine Corps, and I was like, "Yeah, I'll do the Air Force."
Me too.
Yeah, me too. I'm kind of tough. I'm cool. But Jeff was deployed when dad died. And so dad passed about 3 days, I think, before he got back. And yeah, so when he came home to, at the time, divorce papers and a funeral. And yeah, you know, so talk about the impact of...
Did addiction affect him at all?
Yeah. My brother has also had his own struggles. And one thing that I've been grateful for in my recovery is being able to, and we've had our run-ins, we've had contentiousness in our relationship, but being able to have some like empathy and understanding and being able to hold space for maybe what his experience was like, because for so long, you know, in our relationship, I thought about the ways that he wronged me or the things that he did. And then I look back and I'm like, oh my God, that was his dad. Like, yeah, I was a daddy's girl, but he lived with dad and they were, I feel like, closer than my dad and I were. And he never got to say goodbye. He never even got to, you know, and I just think about what he came back to and how hard that must have been for him and how he kind of did similar to what I did, which was just put it away and maybe self-medicate it some. And, when I went
guess
back,
he
to
didn't get that class on feelings either.
No, he did not. He did not receive the class on how to feel your feelings.
Oh, okay.
I think when I went back to school, the idea was that it would just be business as usual. And at my school, you know, it was a dry campus.
Oh, yeah.
It was a moist campus.
I hear this about military. I love this. And we've talked about it before.
Mm-hmm.
But you tell me about like the secrets of the military, right? And that like you're not supposed to drink, but everybody does. And
everybody
you're not supposed to do drugs, but like secretly there's a whole community of something happening.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of unspoken spokens, right?
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit more about that experience in the military.
Yeah. And well,
or military school.
Yeah.
And then
in
the military.
Yeah.
Both, please.
So for especially at a military college, right? I'll speak for the one that I went to. We had our fair share of partying. We just knew, like, everybody seemed to know when to lock it up. Like, people knew, you know, when to put their bottles away and to make sure that you didn't get caught in your barracks room. And, like, and some people didn't get away with it, right? There were people definitely that got kicked out for a violation of alcohol policy or got punishment for that or whatever. But I don't know if I want to say fortunate, but I never got caught. We'll take that fortunate, not fortunate. I don't know. You know, who knows if it would have been headed off if I'd gotten caught, but I never got caught, but I definitely drank to excess. And then on the summers, you know, I would come home and do whatever. I would do coke. I would do pain pills. I was like, never did it occur to me that I was going down a bad path. Because at this point, I had built up, and this is the thing I'll talk about of like the biggest part of my recovery process has been, I had built up such a like narcissistic veneer, such a like shell of, oh, I'm good at this, and I'm good at this, and I'm good at this, that I lived a double life. And as far as I was concerned, I was an exception to the rules, and I was going to find a way to get away with what I wanted to do. And if I got caught, it was the person's fault who caught me and not mine. That is the number one thing that would have kept me locked in the cycle of addiction. For me, there was an absolute necessity to take accountability and responsibility for the wreckage of my past, because there I didn't have the ego strength to handle being told that I was wrong. So I would find a way to make it the system's fault or problem, or you know, that it wasn't my fault that the Air Force caught on to the fact that I was using substances and pulled my commission. It was the fault of the person that turned me in.
Right.
What? Well, here's the thing. Think about what was on the line.
But like your life, really.
I was about to commission in the Air Force as a space and missiles officer.
Yeah, no.
No.
Mm-mm.
No.
Okay. I'm better with that. You're not doing that.
Yeah, I'm better with me.
You could do it now.
I mean, now. But
yeah. Actually, now you'd probably be pretty good.
Now I'd be probably great at it, but I wouldn't want to sit in a missile silo for however long.
God, how scary is it to think that there's someone out there who hasn't been told on, who is in a missile silo, probably with his vodka orange soda? You know, and
God, I hope not. Oh my God, I hope not. I think about it, and you asked this about the military culture. And granted, I've been out since 2015, so I'm speaking for, you know,
okay,
however long ago that was, 10 years.
Not yet, nine.
Oh yeah, nine years. Make me feel better. But you know, I think a large part of what's the unspoken spokens, or the, you know, the what is sort of accepted but not spoken of, has to do with the like niche of military that you're in. It has to do with what your rank is, what your job is, what type of unit you're in. You know, are you combat arms or are you support? Like, are you like, where do you fall on the spectrum? Because you've got everything from Space Force and Space and Missiles that are working on like, you know, multi-million dollar satellites, et cetera, all the way. And I'm going to say down, even though I don't want to make tears out of it, all the way down to kind of
tears.
The job. And admittedly, working on a satellite system versus like a Humvee is different. And that was my job, so I'm allowed to say that. What I ended up doing was, you know, my senior year.
You're allowed to say whatever you want, by the way, just a side note. Go on.
Thank you for permission. But I mean, as far as like, you know,
explaining, I
guess. Yeah, like casting one job is lower than the other. I'm willing to and able to admit that the job I was going to have compared with the job I ended up with, that was a result of my substance use. And I was supposed to end up commissioned as an officer in the Air Force. And my senior year, the guy that I was dating was diagnosed with cancer. And I'm not saying this was the reason I used, but it contributed to what ended up happening as far as I'm going to self-medicate with substances, which was a bad decision. And it ended up for me being Xanax and pain pills, because I had also blown my knee out playing rugby at the time. So I had like, and this is while the pill mills were going on. So when I was coming home, you know, during break or whatever, and came home from my surgery, I had my uncle living at home with the pain pills, and it was just, it was all there. No problem. Easy peasy. And not only did I not need to process the sadness that I felt for not being able to play rugby anymore, because that team was my family, but I didn't have to process like my feelings towards my boyfriend, who I loved, having cancer and what would happen to him. So I just self-medicated it all away. And then someone went to the Air Force detachment and said, hey, you probably want to take a look into what she's doing. And they were right to do that.
Yeah. Thank you to you.
Thank you.
Out there.
Thank you. You know who you are, and I know who you are, and I appreciate you now.
I do. I hated you for a really long time,
and it was my own fault. And the United States of America, the United States Air Force, thanks you.
Yeah, and the citizens of America do.
And the citizens of America.
So then you graduate, and your position is a little lower than you would have liked.
No, so they took my commission. So I was fully out of the service at this time. So when I graduated, I finished my degree in biology, right? And then I went
home. You're at a military school.
Uh-huh.
and you graduate with a degree in biology.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and you go home.
Yep.
And then?
And then the bottom fell out. Yeah. That was when I got into other substances. That was when I started smoking crack.
So you didn't serve. You did.
I did. I did. So I the bottom fell out, and then I enlisted.
That's what I thought. I'm like, wait a minute. Something I'm...
Yeah.
Okay.
So you get a college education, and you go into the service as an officer. You... Versus you can get a high school education and go and enlist it, you know, and they're two different modes of service. But basically I had been trained to be an officer. And after a little bit of time out of the service, I was like, I can't be a civilian. I can't survive in this. But like all of my, what's the word I'm looking for? All of my compatriots, right? All the people that I went to school with, had taken their commissions and were living their lives and were in uniform. And I couldn't stand in my own mind, my ego couldn't stand making that comparison and the idea that I would just be a civilian now and I wouldn't, you know, so.
And they were doing it.
And they were doing it.
And you weren't.
And I wasn't.
And did that feel like failure?
Oh my God. Another thing I self-medicated, right? I didn't process those feelings. I was like, I was completely uninterested in processing any of the feelings.
I can't imagine, right? You are in high school. You're that JRTC whatever person. You're wearing a uniform then. You go to college. You're wearing a uniform then.
Mm-hmm.
You're destined and bound to be in the military. And then you go home and you're not. I mean, I just can imagine that would feel like you didn't do it. You failed.
Right. And that's how I felt. I felt like a failure. And it was, I had failed. It was, you know, it was the consequences of my own actions. And my continued failure to see that was the thing that would end up biting me, was that it was like, hey, these are your behaviors. It's not just the fact that you weren't smart enough doing it and you got caught. It was the fact that you did it. It was the doing of the thing that got you here. Like, why can't you see that? But I you know, at the time I was still very much living in my own reality where like Tamara could do no wrong.
Fault.
Yeah. And it's everyone else's fault.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was fortunate that I ended up being able to enlist in the Army because even after, and I blew out my other knee, like even after those knee surgeries and everything, I was able to enlist. You know, while I was home, my uncle passed away and he was the one that had been, you know, doctor shopping and using the pills. And my closest cousin, that was her dad. And so now we had both lost our dads and, he was also on home hospice and had like died in our living room. And so it was all, I just wanted to get away from home and I really needed to be special. Being special in the way the military allows you to be special was a part of my identity. And I wasn't ready to let that go. So I did enlist and not to belabor everything, but you know, I found what I was looking for in the military too. You know, there are people in the military at the blues were still going on and oxycodone was still everywhere. And so I found a way to do what I wanted to do. And I had, you know, bouts and periods of time where substances were not a part. And I got into 12 steps when I was there and I had a period of time where I was, you know, clean and sober. And, but I just could never hang on to it. For whatever reason, I think I still to this day think that one of the reasons is because I hadn't truly accepted like the adult responsibility of my power to change my behaviors. I was still externalizing blame in a way that disempowered me to change. And that was a big missing piece.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what flipped?
What flipped was when I ended up getting out of the service and I came home. I got a job as a biology teacher and I loved that job and I loved the students that I taught and some of the guilt that I still carry is the fact that I thought it would get me sober and I was still using substances while I was teaching and I ended up resigning in lieu of termination because the administration was gracious to me due to my veteran status. And so there's time number one that being a veteran saved me. Time number two, you know, I became suicidal at that point and ended up reaching out to the VA and the VA sent me to treatment and for free, you know, I mean, you know, not for free, but Right. I didn't pay anything because I got out honorably. I was fortunate to get out honorably, and so that was covered by the VA, and they sent me to treatment. And the first time I went to, a wonderful treatment center that had a music program, and I got involved in playing music. I was playing guitar, and I really enjoyed my time there. But when I got out, I still hadn't cracked that veneer of ego, and so I ended up relapsing, going back in. So the second time the VA sent me, I did a little bit better. I got a little bit further. I found a sponsor I really liked, got a little bit further down the line, but it didn't hold, and some things happened, and I relapsed. And the third time I went in, and I found a letter that I wrote myself when I was in detox up in the mental ward and at the VA. And the letter said something to the effect of, I'm so sorry. I really tried, but I don't think I'm going to be able to get this. There's like something wrong with me. Like, I'm sorry, but I'm pretty sure this is going to kill me. And I don't know who I was writing that letter to, but I finally kind of had to admit defeat, because no matter what I did, I couldn't get my shit together, and I couldn't stop.
When did you find this letter?
When I was going through, my stuff, when I moved into my house that I bought. So
isn't that incredible?
Yeah.
Was that so moving for you?
It highlighted for me what the depths of addiction looked like and what hopelessness sounds like. And it allowed me to sort of reconnect with what I'm eligible for again, if I ever somehow undo all of the work that I've done, or if I, and not as like an outstanding threat, but it definitely reconnected me with the hopelessness that is there at the bottom. And that was my bottom. And my bottom wasn't necessarily like a financial bottom, or my bottom was interpersonal. It was the people that I had recently moved in with, who were very good friends of mine, who had cared about very much, that I betrayed them in that way, them and their family and everyone else that was believing in me at the time. The last time I used, I was on so many benzos that I blacked out, and I ate like 18 mochi ice creams, and like took the smoke detector out of the wall and smoked in the house, and then went and scored heroin, and then disappeared for 2 days. I have no idea. To this day, I have no idea where I went or what I did.
That's like not the woman I know today, which
right?
is so crazy to me. Like, and people say it to me too. They're like, I just can't picture that. And I'm like, but that's the reality.
Yeah. And how nice to hear that I'm a person today that you wouldn't be able to picture that.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of the hope that I want to give people out there listening, is that like, it can look that bad, and then it can all change.
It can.
And it's like another world.
Yep.
Another universe, another dimension, you know, totally another dimension.
Yeah. Yeah. Another person entirely. The person you were always supposed to be,
right,
maybe, and wanted to be and knew was in there.
Or even better than you were supposed to be.
Yeah.
Because I think that having met all the people I've met, having heard all the strong stories, having reached the spiritual awakening, having had everything stripped from me, and then restarting, I think I'm better than if back then I just, went from the internship to the job, and I wouldn't have done all this work on myself.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I would have still been like an angry person, and I would have still had an attitude with people, and I would still be like a mediocre Irene,
Yeah.
And I mean, like, the transformation I've seen in you is so incredible. And I mean, you've always been so incredibly smart, but it's just so cool to see just how people evolve in this, right?
Yeah. And how, if you commit yourself to a journey of growth, being in recovery is not the end of it. That is the beginning of it. That
right.
is the start of the path. You know, the person I was then, the ways that I treated people, not not that I went out of my way to be an asshole, but just my level of like conscientiousness, I thought feeling guilty was enough. And like the person I am today, if I'm going to be 6 minutes late to something, I send you a text and I say, sorry.
I respect your time. I'm like, I know you do.
I value your time and I apologize that I'm going to be late. You know, like that's the person that I can stand behind her actions. I can stand behind the way that she treats people and in her life. And that's an amazing feeling. Because when I look back on my bottom and just the people around me, how disappointed they were, because they were hurt. It wasn't, they didn't want to shame me or make me feel bad. It's because they were hurt. They wanted better for me. And they had seen these glimmers of the person I could be. Mm-hmm. And I had seen glimmers of the person I could be. I knew what she could look like. But substances were in the way and I just couldn't get there.
Yeah.
So I ended up having... That bottom opened the door for my spiritual experience, which, you know, I had always been kind of atheistic and agnostic in a way where, not in a, I don't know kind of way, in a, I do know, and here's why we don't need God, and here's what, like in the aggressive, defensive kind of way where you're like, okay, why? Why do you feel that?
Yeah.
But all right.
Especially when science has proven that something
else. Yeah. You know, anyway, with my biology background, I was like, let me tell you, which there's no problem with that if you want to have a discourse and a conversation, but that wasn't my intent. My intent was to be right. My intent was always to be right and tell you why you're wrong. And it was just like, that's not conducive to good relationships.
Well, right. And it's also like at one point for me, it was like, I was very similar and it was like, wait, people don't want to be around this. Like, what, you people don't like me? Like, what? I'm so confused. Like, why? I'm right. such an awesome person.
Right, and I'm right so often. And you
right, don't. You should know better. And it's incredible how, like, that's like the wake-up call. Like, oh, God, it's not just substances. It's like, I need to change. That's a lot of work.
There are aspects of my character that are objectionable to other people. Who knew? Why didn't anyone tell me? And they're like, we tried to tell you. You didn't listen to anybody. Yeah. So it's like, it's cool to be in recovery and be able to be like, oh, I can own my actions in a way that's meaningful.
So you were saying how you were on this two-day bender, disappeared with heroin. What? Was that the end?
That was the end. I ended up in an ambulance, ended up in a Nashville hospital. The people I was living with at the time, my dear friends, you know, put me on a plane and sent me home. They actually called my mom. My mom was like, I don't know, figure it out. I'm done. Like, my mom finally reached her breaking point, and I think that played a role in how good our relationship is today. And now we get to the point. Now we get to the, like, what happened at the end, the good stuff, and then the what it's like now, because... What happened at the end was I worked with a therapist who pulled absolutely no punches. And, you know, I had lied to him on my intake. And then I think on my second day there, I had this very strange spiritual experience that I still, like, I don't try to explain it away because I don't need to understand what it was. As far as I'm concerned, it was the universe intervening on my behalf to show me that I am not the end all be all. And I do need help. And should I need it and reach for it, it is there. But I remember them saying, and like, I decided to go to some of the more religious groups and, you know, and then they were like, well, you have to invite God into your heart. And I was like, fuck, how do you do that? Like, so I remember going back to my room in rehab and I was standing there and I was like, well, I got a half hour. I wonder if I could try this. Right. And I was like, oh, God or whatever. I guess if you're there, you could come into my heart or whatever. You could like, whatever doesn't. And I had this sudden overwhelming feeling of not being alone. And again, it is not something I try to put into a specific religious category. It's not something I try to explain or understand because my experience of it was meaningful enough that I was like, all right, whatever's supposed to happen, you, it, the ether, you got it. You got it. You just tell me what to do. I'll keep doing the next right thing. And that's what I did. I started actually listening to people. Instead of raising my hand in groups to share my experience
Or argue.
Or tell people. Or let me elaborate on that. That's actually when dopamine in the brain, blah, blah, blah. Like, we get it. You have a degree. You don't just, what if you just, I started trying this new thing, which was where I looked around the room and I realized every single person in that room had unique experiences and they knew things that I didn't. And that made them worthy of, they had intrinsic value and that made them worthy of respect as human beings. And that was also guidance I got from my therapist at the time. I would criticize someone or say something really shitty in our one-on-ones and he'd be like, poor them. And I was like, what do you mean poor them? They annoyed me. And it was like, they don't even know that. I was like, oh my God, he's right. Something about making everyone else beneath me like was okay to me and it made me feel better about myself. But I hadn't realized I didn't need to make other people feel small for me to feel okay yet. I hadn't gotten there. And that was my biggest journey, was I hit my bottom. I had a spiritual awakening. I surrendered. Whatever that looks like for you might be different. But for me, it meant inviting in the fact that other people were just as valuable as I was, and I didn't need to constantly establish myself as the smartest or best one in the room in order to just be a person among people. Mm. And that was what recovery looked like for me.
I love that. So what did you do early on that you would say, like, if you were giving a message to someone, and I know you're a therapist and you know, you work with so many people in this, but what would you say that you did in the beginning that was profound for you that you think attributed to your sobriety today? Aside from what you just said, yeah, obviously, but what are like measurable steps people can do to be like, I'm on a path?
I started by getting brutally honest. Like I said, I had lied to that therapist on my intake. And on the second day after I had that experience, I like basically busted in his office and was like, by the way, I'm full of it. And I don't know why I lied to you, but I just decided to do that sometimes. And I got honest about all the shame I was carrying. I listened to what people told me to do. Even if I thought it wasn't going to work or I thought I knew better, I was like, I don't care. I'm going to try it anyway. I called other women. I, you know, got close to people who were also in recovery. I worked with a sponsor, and when she told me to do something, I didn't care if it made me feel uncomfortable. I did it. And it doesn't mean that every piece of advice you get from every person is going to be the thing that changes. It's the willingness to take the advice and to allow things to be different that is what invites the change in. So things started to change. Basically, what happened was I lived in halfway. I was 33 years old. My car was in Nashville. So I either walked or rode a bike to meetings, went, I know, right, in the Florida heat. And I remember looking back on that and being like, wow, when I get my car back, I will never be like this appreciative of what's around me ever again. I remember like looking at the clouds and just being grateful, like experiencing and practicing gratitude actively. I would go to as many meetings as I could. I kept myself hooked into a community. I listened when people suggested things. And then at about 9 months, my grandma needed a place to stay. And so I got an apartment and we moved in together. She moved in with me. And I am so eternally grateful that I had that opportunity. Because I got to live with her for 5 years. And then she passed away in March. And, you know, this was a woman that I stole from at the height of my addiction. And I got to give back to her in the most meaningful way with my time and my love and, you know, my support. And she got to see me. She got to go to my grad school graduation. And she got to see me put my life together and be the person, be the young woman that she raised, you know? She knew when she went that she didn't have to worry about me. And that was... that's one of the best gifts that my recovery has given me.
I remember you said to me, I bought a house and my grandma and my mom are moving in and I'm so happy because I get to take care of them like they took care of me, you know? And I just thought that was so admirable.
And I really, when I came over and did the whole lightsaber or whatever thing, and I remember meeting your grandma, meeting your mom, and they're such kind people. And you really are that kind person, you know? You really are such a giving and loving person. And, like, I'm so glad that you had that, you know? I know how much she means to you.
Yeah. And it's been weird to have the experience, like, talking more about what it's like now, to have the experience of going through grief for the first time in my life, going through grief and going like, oh, this is okay. This is okay. I don't
actually feeling all the feelings.
Yeah.
How would you say you're handling that differently than you did when you were younger? I mean, you lost three major figures in your life, and I know your grandma's a major figure in your life. So how would you say your grief is different now than it was? What are you doing different? Or is it just being graceful with you, like giving yourself some grace?
That's kind of the biggest part for me is like, I know it's going to come and I don't have to force it. I don't have to feel guilty when I'm not sad. I don't have to, cause like, you know, this is what it was like. After she passed, mom and I, we had some anger about the way she passed too, because she wasn't as comfortable as she could have been, but she was in our house the whole time, my house the whole time. So mom and I got up at 2 a.m. and that ended up being, you know, the night she passed. And again, just like when Will passed, we were on either side of her hospital bed. We were right there with her when she took her last breath. So we were processing the grief together. So number one, I'm not alone in the grief. Number two, I'm talking about it, right? I'm not afraid to talk about it. And number three, I'm not setting expectations on it. I'm not expecting that I'm going to feel this way or not going to feel this way or supposed to feel this way, because mom and I went to lay her to rest up in the town that she's from, up near Buffalo, and in New York. And we got to meet, like, you know, Eden, New York, this tiny little town. And we got to, meet like all the other family members and her sisters and everything. And then afterwards, mom and I went to Niagara Falls, and I, you know, it's not like, oh, we're supposed to be sad. We're grieving. We're in mourning. We need to put, you know, put on some show for ourselves internally to show how sad we are. Like, no, mom spent so much time caring for grandma and being there for grandma. We deserved a little vacay. And so we went on one, and allowing it all to exist together, the joy and the sadness and the grief and the missing and the all of it, because it doesn't come in a specific order. And if the more you set expectations on the way you're supposed to feel, the more you're going to feel things about the way you do or don't feel. And it just let it be. Just let it be.
That's so profound. Thank you so much for sharing.
Yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely. The other parts of my life right now, like I couldn't be more grateful. And just to, you know, I went back to grad school. So not only did, you know, the VA help me with rehab, but I got to use my GI Bill to go back to grad school. And then I used my VA home loan to buy a home. And so I've just had so many opportunities in recovery that I am just immensely grateful for, that have given me or helped me to build a life where I do give back to people. So, you know, becoming a mental health counselor, and then I did sort of step away from meetings and like a 12-step approach to recovery. And when I did that, I was like, the thing that's missing is service, and I needed a way to give back somehow. And I had a friend who is a scout leader in Boy Scouts of America, or BSA, for a girls' troop. And so now I'm an assistant scoutmaster in our local Boca Raton girls troop.
So you're bringing it back.
Yeah. Yeah. I was like, I need something where I'm giving of myself, because as much as I love being a counselor, that's also my job. It's my vocation. And when you're of service, it's supposed to be an avocation, right? It's supposed to be work you're doing that you're doing out of the goodness of your heart, altruistically or somewhat altruistically. And so I've really enjoyed doing that. You know, I own my home. My mom lives with me. We play backgammon multiple times a week.
So you give back to the community. And what would you say, you know, because I've talked to, and I hope this is okay that I'm bringing it up, but, you know, I've talked to you about like this 12-step process and how
I don't go to as many meetings as I used to go to. I used to be miss yeah. and do the chairing and do the this and do the that. And I still go. I still am a part of, but there's this guilt in me. It's kind of like that Jewish guilt and Greek guilt is similar guilt. And then there's this like 12-step guilt where like, am I not sober if I don't go? Am I sober if I don't go as much?
Right.
And please like speak to that, because I really love on this podcast how we talk about how that is a huge tool and it's very helpful for people, but there are many people who can do it and they don't have to necessarily be like go to a meeting every day and all of that. So talk about how yeah. like that changed for you.
And I think this is important to talk about because you know, the research that is out there now supports that there is more than one way to recover. And it also supports that one of the most helpful things about 12-step fellowships is the fellowship aspect.
Well, right.
Is the community aspect. Right. And so if you can find a way to create community for yourself and enrich your life, that's what's going to be a really, really helpful part. Our mm-hmm. relationships are what make our lives rich. Mm-hmm. But I think for me early on, the reason it was so vital early on is I needed people, a specific type of people, right? Mm-hmm. Who weren't going to kind of let me get away with things. Like they were going to hold me to a certain standard. And that's why 12 steps was useful for me in the beginning, especially. And it also allowed me, like it set a standard for me and a model. And it showed me the way of what being of service looks like, what getting outside yourself looks like. All of that said, and that is all true, self-contained on its own. That is how it helped me, and I'm eternally grateful. All of that said, there is sometimes a way that the principles are introduced that can feel for some people dogmatic or rigid. And that shouldn't be something that turns you away from recovery, sobriety, whatever. There are other recovery options now. There's, you know, as far as meetings and fellowship goes, there's Smart Recovery.
Oh,
there's
yeah,
Recovery
there's a ton.
Dharma. I go to Recovery Dharma. Like mm-hmm. I really enjoy that there are other options out there for people. And so the thing is, I would hate for people to avoid 12 steps because of one specific reason or another to do with, you know, whether it's religion or whether it's like they see it as a cult or they see the people involved and they don't find it attractive in their area. Like I've heard tons of different reasons, right? From mm-hmm. clients and from friends alike. But the one thing that I can say is that recovery can look different for different people. So like, let's say that you do go to 12-step meetings in order to get your feet under you. That doesn't mean that you're stuck there for the rest of your life. And yes, there's people who will tell you that if,
yeah.
And for some people, that's true. For some people, if they stop going,
it works well.
Yeah. And for some people, if they stop going, that's like their bread and butter. And like, that would be really detrimental for them. And then, but there are some people that I know that have found success in getting their lives together and then 12 steps or whatever fellowship they're doing, whatever program they're doing, it gave them a life. It doesn't have to become their life. Mm-hmm. You don't have to feel locked in a way that feels like oppressive or that it multiplies shame. It should be something that adds to your life.
That's how I feel when I go now. I really feel like it's adding to, I love still being a part of, I love still doing that, but the guilt has like subsided, right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be 6-7 meetings a week.
Right.
And I agree with you. There's the fellowship is so important and creating a community. And I always tell people early in recovery, the reason why those 12-step meetings are easy is because they've already set it up for you.
Yeah.
You don't have to figure it out on your own because you're already figuring out so much how to feel, like how to deal with
how
so
to be
many
a human.
Things. It's like sometimes it's nice to be able to say that's already happening at 7 a.m. or that's already happening at 6 p.m. and you don't have to figure out a whole new way.
Yes.
But you know, once you do get your bearings, it's about service, giving back, it's about community, and it's about taking accountability and responsibility for yourself, your life, and your actions, right? For me, yeah. It's like at the end of the night, I want to sit down and be like, okay, what did I do today that was useful? What can I do better tomorrow? Do I owe an apology? Like some of these questions apply always, mm-hmm. you know, with or without 12 steps. So I think that taking accountability, being accountable to other people and all of that is important. And there is other ways, right? There's
yeah.
many ways. There's 12 steps. There's community building things. And, you know, I love that you talk about that. And you've also been so supportive for me in that respect. I'm so grateful to you.
Thank you. I'm grateful to you too. I can't believe it's been so long and now you're doing this, and it's just, and this is what I mean by the fellowship, right? Where did we meet? We met in a 12-step program.
Yeah.
And like,
and we're
still
friends today.
Right. Most, and that is one thing that I can say is like, that is one of the benefits, is that most of the people that are a huge part of my life to this day, whether or not either of us is still doing the 12-step thing, they have their life together. They're a value add to my life, and I know I'm a value add to theirs. And that is not something that most of the people around me when I was in my active addiction, or any of the people around me in active addiction, could have said about me. Like, oh, she's a value add. Yeah. That was not something they would say. And now it's across the board.
Yeah. Oh, my God. For me, it's like, all of a sudden I was like, why aren't people including me anymore? Why aren't people adding? It's because nobody wants you around. You know what I mean? Like, at some point you have to be like, oh, maybe it's me. Maybe am I the problem?
And it is sad, and it is lonely, and it is isolating in a way that I think 12-step programs or fellowships in general directly like push back against. And that is what I find like is just so meaningful there. I think there's also a legacy to be acknowledged of like the way that women being around women, like I understand that 12-step fellowships, some of them, and pause, we may or may not want to include this, depends on how you feel. I wouldn't be offended if you cut it out, but 12-step fellowships, what they were kind of established on was a very male-oriented way of thinking, a very male-dominated, like a patriarchal structure, you know? And when you look at, you know, we're looking at things from a, oh gosh, how do I say this without, whatever, I'm just going to say it. The way that women are socialized, sometimes when you apply 12 steps to that, people can miss the mark in applying that fourth and fifth step and eighth and ninth. And I say that keeping my therapeutic brain like right here, is that, you know, if a woman is socialized to be particularly self-sacrificing, particularly people-pleasing, right? You're going to potentially come to the fourth and fifth and look at your resentments, and then come to the eighth and ninth and look at like who you owe in amends. And you're going to turn all your shame and your guilt around in on yourself. And like, that is not the point of this work. Yes, you should take accountability, but more than that, you should figure out, like I said before, where your power is and the things that are not yours to take accountability for. And this is where it's important to have people that are your counsel that you trust, the things that are not yours to take accountability for.
But I think that also has to do with who you're working with,
yes,
right? And how they tell you to handle things. And let
Agreed.
Me just tell you, this is something that I remember, the book never bothered me, right? The he, the God, the this, all of those, for me, those are just words.
Yeah.
I can see beyond it. I can see the word alcohol, and I can exchange it for Adderall, cocaine, ecstasy, whatever. I did them all at once.
Right,
you know,
fill in
I
the
mean?
Blank. Yeah,
fill in the blank. And it's like, I tell people sometimes, I'm like, don't get hung up on the words. If you get hung up on the words, that's where you're going to stay, right?
Yeah.
Just try to remember that this was a book written in the 1930s, right?
Yeah, consider the time.
And I know they've changed the wording and that pass, and there's going to be a new version of the book and with more gender neutral and things like that, which is wonderful. I'm more inclusive, the better it is for me. But I tell people in general, like, try not to get caught up in the he said, she said.
Because
it's not going to serve you.
When I was, and this I can say, and I'm speaking for myself here, and anyone that relates to this, awesome. But when I was focusing on the fact that God was in there, right? And I was looking at the word God, and I was looking at the he's and everything, it was not coming from a part of me that was ready to have an adult mature discourse, right, on the legacy of the patriarchy in 12-step fellowships. That was not the part of me that it was coming from. Mm-hmm. It was the part of me that wanted to look anywhere but where it hurt. That was, for me, where it was coming from. And that's not to say that there aren't, like, the people that brought those concerns, I think they were coming from the adult part of them that wanted to have a real discourse. For me, it was about distracting myself from the real issue. And the real issue at the time was not the word God in the book. It was me. It was what Tamara was doing.
I love that you said that. And I do think that, you know, you have to be in the right place.
Yeah.
You know, you have to be ready to take a look at the good, the bad, the ugly, the fact that you have to change, the fact that it's not about the alcohol or the drug. It's really about the behaviors, you know, the underlying stuff, what we carry with us. And, you know, all the shame and guilt, like how to find your power. I'm all about find your power. You know that.
Yes.
I'm a big believer in like people finding their power. And also, like, we talked about it in an earlier interview, actually, that Corey did. And, you know, it's like, you can't always give a shit what everyone thinks. Because guess what? As my dad would say, and I love this, is that he's like, there are going to be people that love you. There are going to be people that hate you. No matter what. You could be perfect. If somebody doesn't like you or if somebody wants to talk shit, they will find something. They will make it up. You know? And he basically told me in high school, like, you do you. I don't think he meant it, though, and like, you do you and
do
all the
whatever
drugs
you
did.
Want.
But I think he meant it, and I see it now today. It's like, we've got to be authentic, and we've got to speak from the heart, and remember that this is like the feel your feelings class, right? Is that what I learned in treatment when people were like, I felt this way. I'm like, I felt that way, too, and it made me feel okay. It made me feel like, oh, wow, there people feel like I feel, you know, it's okay. I'm going to be okay. And so I love that you talk about that because that's what it's about is like making sure that you find your power and you find your breath, you know?
Yeah. I love that you – because I was literally having this conversation with somebody earlier. And I think I bring this up frequently also in sessions with my clients of like, you need to be okay with being the bad guy in someone else's story. That doesn't mean that you're so okay with it, you never examine your behaviors. That is not what that means, right?
No,
it's like, oh,
right.
I'm just the bad guy in your story is whatever. No, you do need to critically examine your actions. But there are going to be people who don't like you and there are going to be times that you hurt someone, you go to make an amends and they want nothing to do with it. And it is okay that you're the villain in that story now. You need to be comfortable with the discomfort of that because not everybody's going to like you. And that's part of being authentic.
And you're not going to like everyone.
Yeah, right? You don't like everyone. How can you expect everyone to like you? That's not how the world works.
Yeah, but people are going to talk and you're going to talk sometimes. Like, you know, it's just kind of like look in the mirror.
And that, I think, if there's one thing that is like has been the central theme recently in my recovery – after the loss of grandma, after this past week where a bunch of stuff happened, I got in that car accident. Like it was just one thing after another. It was the feeling of, I am capable of finding peace even when things are not peaceful.
Oh, that's so powerful.
And never could you have told me that that would be the greatest achievement of my life, but it is.
That's incredible. So is there anything I ask everyone this and, you know, is there anything that you would tell your younger self, whatever age you choose the age, and what would you say, right? So like how old are you picturing in Tamara's brain and what are you going to say to her?
Oh, I saw her at 7 years old playing in the front yard in Pompano. And if there's one thing, and I know that she wouldn't be able to hear this, but one thing I would want her to know is that you are special. You don't have to spend so much energy proving it to everyone. You're special because you're you. It sounds so corny coming out of my mouth, but
it's so true.
But yeah. Yeah.
I love that.
You're special because you're a human being and you're you.
And you are pretty special. really smart, like grossly smart. Like sometimes I'm like, oh, let's call Tamara. thank you so much. Thank you for sharing everything. Thank you for getting vulnerable and being you and
thank
authentically you.
You.